He holds all creation together in himself. And I come back to that so often because that is, I mean, creation in all of its paradox and its fallenness and its brokenness and its capacity for good and evil and everything else, that somehow he is holding it all together. And that's why it exists. And that doesn't answer the hard questions at all, but it's, you know, it's like there is, somebody is holding this. It's not all going to shatter, you know, somehow in ways that we can't see, it does cohere.
I spoke last spring with Sally Thomas about her 2020 poetry collection, Motherland, as well as her novel, Works of Mercy, published in 2022. A former guest on this podcast, she's published poetry, fiction, reviews, and essays in such venues as First Things, Plow Quarterly, and The New Yorker. And she's co-edited with Micah Maddox the anthology Christian Poetry in America since 1940. She serves as associate poetry editor of The New York Sun. I'm Matthew Wickman of the BYU Faith and Imagination Institute. Okay, Sally, so last season when I had you and Micah Maddox on to talk about your anthology, Christian Poetry in America since 1940, Micah mentioned that one of the downsides to your work on the anthology was you decided it best to exclude your own poetry from it. Okay, so we're talking about that today and also your novel, Works of Mercy. Let me begin by a question of categorizing. So your collection of poems, Motherland, is filled with beautiful poetry. I love them. Do you consider these to be Christian poems, like the ones that you edited in the anthology? And would you label yourself a Christian poet?
I think my answer to both of those questions is yes, although the backdrop to that answer is that, I mean, because I am a practicing and believing Christian, it's hard to imagine that anything that I wrote wouldn't be framed by that. I mean, you know, this is how I understand reality. So I heard a really interesting talk. This is an answer to that question, but it's going to seem like an aside. I heard a really interesting talk last fall by the novelist Christopher Beja. And I've been kind of chewing on these ideas ever since. I mean, this was at the Catholic Imagination Conference, and so he was speaking specifically about Catholic fiction in his talk. And he said that he had devised this kind of system in his mind where there were two categories. And one was what he called, and he's talking about novels, one was the Roman novel, which dealt specifically with church, you know, in which characters go to church, or somebody prays a rosary, or there's a priest, or it's about an order of nuns. I mean, Rumor Gardens in This House of Breed would, you know, be an obvious example that comes to my mind. And he said, you know, you can, and obviously you can extrapolate this in a wider sense that, you know, from any faith tradition, you can have work, poetry or fiction or whatever, that is dealing explicitly with Christian content, I guess, for lack of a better word. And that was the direction that we went in the anthology. But the thing that he said to me that seemed particularly resonant was that, you know, he said, when I sit down to write, you know, I am a believer, and I don't, you know, I bring my whole self to whatever I do. And that includes, you know, my faith. And, you know, I mean, in one sense, you can't even say it's this add-on that I take, you know, it's my carry-on luggage that I take everywhere I go. I mean, it really is your perception of reality. It's how you understand reality. So no matter where you're casting your gaze, if you are a believer and that is the way that you understand the whole cosmos to work, then inevitably in some way that's going to inform what you write. I mean, that might be something that only you know as the writer, you know, I mean, somebody else might read, you know, a poem of mine and just say, well, you know, this is just about bees, or this is just about being a mother or whatever. And that's okay, but you know, anything I do is just inevitably going to be circumscribed by the fact of my faith.
I like that answer.
So that's a very qualified yes.
Yeah, no, I like that answer. Because I know that some people, I've talked to people before who are uncomfortable kind of wearing the label of religious poet or Christian poet or Christian writer.
Right.
And because they don't want to be pigeonholed, and that seems fair. And yet that that assumes that it's all about content and not about and somehow this permeated worldview. I know at BYU where I teach, there's a it's a religious university, and there's a phrase that a church leader used years ago to describe the way the gospel should permeate classes. It's not that it's always the content of a class, but he used the analogy of or like the metaphor of perfume, that the content should be lightly perfumed with the fragrance of the gospel, as though what he's saying is it's not always a thing that's overt, but it's there somehow. It's an aura. It's a part of how the world is imagined. It's certainly not imagined in contradiction to. Right.
Yeah, that makes sense to me too. I mean, in one sense, that is your sense of what is true. And your sense of what is true is going to permeate everything that you say and do. And you don't have to be constantly going, you know, bringing in a scripture reference or whatever to qualify everything that you say. Or, you know, I mean, you can talk about the Aeneid without saying...
This is an allegory.
But Jesus is God. You know, I mean, okay, that's fine. You can just let that be true and talk about Aeneas in his world. And, you know, you don't have to sort of baptize everything.
But, yeah, good.
You know, but, that's you know, a, that's but a, because God is holding all of this in his mind. You know, it's like it's not our work necessarily to make true things true. They just are.
Yeah, good. And I like that as a way to kind of get at some of your work, because your work, it's characterized, I think, by so much subtlety. And it's really, it's elegant, and it requires, I mean, real attention, I think, to appreciate all the layers that happen inside of your work, which I think it's a quality of the best writing, is that kind of subtlety. Let me quote here from the foreword to your collection, Motherland. The poet David Middleton makes a remark about your poetry that I find really provocative. In fact, I think this characterizes also your fiction, which we'll get to in a little bit too, all right? But here's what Middleton writes. I'm quoting him now. The world that Thomas so deeply apprehends is a place of danger, wonder, beauty, evil, good, relationship, isolation, anxiety, passion, pain, and adventure. Yet this world seems to exist in and of itself, unaware, and thus indifferent to the human need to know and interpret and give a meaning to things. That was very insightful. And what I love about it is that it captures the subtlety and the mystery that for me captures so many of your poems. I guess my question for you is, are these qualities, you know, subtlety and mystery that you associate with the objects of your attention as a poet, like is subtlety and mystery part of the world as you perceive it, or is it more a reflex of how you write, that the way you write elicits these qualities in the objects of your attention?
Yeah, that's a hard question to answer because I don't really know, you know, like this is not something that I'm conscious of at all. And I mean, I'm so grateful to David Middleton for this foreword because, you know, I learned a lot about what it is I'm doing. I mean, I think he hit a lot of nails on the head and, you know, that's one of them. But I didn't know that until he had said it. And I thought, oh, yeah, you know, actually, that's true. I mean, I know that I am drawn in my reading of other poets to a certain sense of strangeness and mystery in their work. I mean, a hugely influential poet for me is the Cornish poet Charles Cawsley, who died, I think, in 2004, and whose work I discovered. Actually, his poems for children were how I discovered him, because we were living in England with our little children and checked his children's poetry out of the library. And I probably still owe overdue fines on it, even now, the library fugitive on two continents. And even in his children's poetry, which is often funny, it's often merry, it's very clever, But there is this sense of, you know, this resonant mystery and wonder and even like this thread of elegy sometimes that's going to, you know, things are, and again, even in this verse for children, which my little children loved, there's this massive emotional complexity. And this definitely carries over into his, I mean, there's not that much difference often in his poetry for children and his poetry for adults. There's that same, the surfaces are very simple. And this is exactly what I'm drawn to, you know, poetry that engages with traditional forms. I mean, he writes a lot in the old ballad form and has these very simple surfaces, yet it's extremely, I mean, subtle is a good word in the sense of having a lot of emotional complexity under the surface that you apprehend, and I can't explain how you apprehend it. You just know it's there. You know, it's this intuitive, you know, response that you have to it. And I mean, to me, that's something deeply pleasurable and interesting to experience as a reader. And so I'm, you know, intuitively as a writer, I guess I'm often spurred to write by things that I read. I mean, one of the questions that I like to ask other poets is, you know, what poets do you read that make you want to write? Mm. Because that's a big category for me, you know, that I'll be reading something and I will just think, I need to go write. I don't know what I need to write, but I need to write toward something that this other poem has raised for me. And it is that sort of sense of things not being as straightforward as their surfaces might suggest. And, you know, that there is just mystery in the world,
yeah.
You know, that the God who is holding the world in his hand is like the God of Job, who answers questions by saying, well, you know what? You weren't there when I made the world, so I don't really have to answer you.
That's right.
You know, that as much as our human minds can apprehend, and of course, we're made to pursue truth. We're made to move in the direction of, you know, knowing more and more of what's true, because that's how we draw closer to God. But there's always, you know, there are always going to be limits for us. And there's always going to be more out there. And to me, I don't know, that's just fascinating to me.
Yeah. So Charles Cosley, I don't know, I've not read that poetry. I'm going to look for that because I like that kind of thing you're describing. I wonder if we could turn to a couple of poems in your book Motherland here and talk about these qualities, I think, in your work. I'm looking at one poem, if that's okay, the poem Frost, which is a nice poem of what, five, you know, sort of quatrains, these four-line stanzas, you know. So would you read this poem for us and we'll talk about it?
Yeah. I mean, I will say about this poem, this is an old poem that I wrote while we were living in Cambridge, which was 1999 to 2003. So I was, you know, I mean, one of the things about Motherland is that it represents about 25 years worth of work. Hmm. So I was in lots of different places in lots of ways.
Sure.
But this is one of the Cambridge poems. Frost. Sun struck at noon, the stiffened grass stands blades up, hilts down, like buried knives that from this window distance simply glitter. Fool's gold, fool's silver, fool's snow. On the roped off cricket pitches, seagulls natter, their scrappy whiteness dark against the whiteness of frost and full bore sunshine. Every shadow shrinks into what casts it. Nothing moves or seems to move, though three teenaged boys knock a football back and forth. Is it lunch break already? Watched by blue sweat-shirted girls who elbow, laugh, and pass around a smoke. The fag end brightens on their lips. Their small noise splinters on the brittle air. It whirls up in white wing beats and dissolves with a shriek into the sky. Tricky winter light and my own eye bend the world, if not to beauty, then to strangeness, on which the cold sun shines and the grass shines back like knives.
Okay, I there are so many poems in this collection that I just love. What got me about this one was kind of that aphoristic conclusion with the setup of the image that you create earlier in the poem, right? So this last stanza, tricky winter light and my own eye bend the world, if not to beauty, then to strangeness. Now that for me, that line is set up perfectly by the juxtaposition of the cold stiffness of the grass, you know, and this winter, and its location, the schoolyard, you know, where some guys are kicking around a ball and girls are kind of watching and smoking and trying to look cool. I mean, the lines there, you know, the lines like, there's small noise splinters on the brittle air. It whirls up in white wing beats and dissolves with a shriek into the sky. It's just, it's a great line, and it converts the scene of just kind of mundane everyday reality and even teenage petulance, right. into a scene of like this really startling, almost melancholic beauty. It evokes something of the passage of time. There's something just so very vividly just there, everydayness about, you know, teenagers being teenagers, but a sense too of like almost like lost time. There's something Proustian almost about it, this remembrance of things past. And it's like this sense of beauty and strangeness. It's part of God's creation. And I'm wondering about that dual effect, this effect of the mundane and mysterious. Am I reading the poem correctly? Is this how you see it? Was this part of your vision in writing it?
Yeah, you know, I can't really remember what my vision was in writing it, or what. I mean, I can tell you what the scene was, which I know I was responding to. We lived in this building in Cambridge that looked out on this big open park called Parker's Piece, which is cute. It's like 16 acres of just flat open, and they play cricket on it in the summer. And it was really like this, you know, like we didn't need a television because there was always something happening right outside our windows. And I spent a lot of time, you know, sitting at my desk and at the window and looking out. And there was something, I mean, I think a lot about the quality of the winters there, which are, you know, like they don't get a lot of snow. It's not even really that cold, but it feels, you know, you get this Siberian wind that's blowing in. I mean, it's just this cold. You know, I mean, you've lived in Scotland.
Indeed.
You know, I mean, it's not quite Scotland. It's a different quality from Scotland, but just, and I can see it in my mind's eye even now, just the brilliance of these winter days when the sun actually shone, and just how hard and, I don't know, brittle is one of those words I use a lot. And I often, I mean, it's probably a tick that I have to talk about the brittle air, but it just often feels that way, you know, like the world like this eggshell. And I think, you know, it's again, I have no idea really what I was thinking. I mean, I look at the last stanza and I think, I wonder why I said that. You know, how did I get there? I don't know. It's been so long, I have no idea. Except that it did, what did draw me, and that I wanted, I guess, to write toward, insofar as I can remember what I was doing at all, it, you know, was that sense of like, why am I even writing about this scene? And it's not just pretty. I mean, it is beautiful, you know, this crystalline world and these seagulls that are flying up. But yeah, I guess I just wanted it to be, you know, like, is this beautiful or is it just weird?
Yeah, yeah, right.
Weirdness is beautiful too, you know.
No, it is. Well, this word brittle. I'm struck by that because I do see that word appearing. I mean, not compulsively, but it's there. It's a feature of some of your poems, when it's not named, it's also evocatively kind of like the mood of some poems. But it kind of it's a way of kind of like it's like the image itself, which is dense and layered with feeling. Is so easily distracted. The image itself is brittle in that we can be drawn away from it so easily, but drawn away from it, we're drawn away to, in some ways, what moves us about life when we stop and pause and think about any part. All around us, there are miraculous things that occur, you know, just the beauty of things or the poignancy of certain moments of life, as mundane as they appear. And we're drawn away from that so easily that the brittleness actually is a way of capturing the need to attend carefully to what is so easily lost.
Yeah, because it's so, you know, it's fragile. It's like a snow globe. And I mean, one of the things that I have realized about myself, kind of in hindsight, is just how much I'm thinking about time. And I mean, this kind of, it's the Proustian thing that you were saying, just, you know, that there are these moments and they're gone so fast. You know, we're caught in time so that we can't ever just stop and say, okay, here, I'm just going to stay here. Because it's just, it's constantly fleeing away from us. And that's another aspect, I guess, of that quality of fragility that's interesting to me, you know, that all of life is like that, you know, that there's this beauty, but it just breaks itself open and moves on almost as you're understanding that it's beautiful.
Yeah, lovely. Before we turn to the novel, maybe one more poem in here. I think it's just, this poem just really just hammers me. It's a Burial in Holy Week. It's on page 41.
Great.
This is this lovely but very, very poignant poem. Would you read this for us, Burial in Holy Week?
Yes, Burial in Holy Week. And I'll try to do it. More than 10 years ago, and I still kind of choke up.
Yeah,
seriously. I was at this funeral. So, Burial in Holy Week. All our lives are just an eyelash, said my friend beside her baby's grave. The troubled sky galloped above the narrow, cold red wound opened in violet-starred grass. A monastery graveyard, a strange, apt place for a girl to find herself in white, an involuntary bride in a celibate communion, facing God who had given and received in one dread day. The little box was settled into earth, heavy coverlet turned up, the clotted clay spaded smooth. Then having seen this birth complete, the new womb closed, the other children ran laughing among the modest ordered headstones in the wind, beneath the veiled and sinking sun, alive as fire, brief and hungry, with that abandon, which is a kind of praise, throwing pine cones.
Okay, wow, right. I mean, just even the last couple words, throwing pine cones, you know, so the scene here is just devastating, right? The burial of an infant, you know, the kind of funeral that's anything but a celebration of life. I mean, what it says here, I mean, just, you know, facing God who had given and received in one dread day. I mean, just, it's so heavy. And yet, for all this heaviness and sense of loss, not just loss of a loved one, but lost possibility, when a child mm-hmm. dies, there's all this possibility and dream and hope, it suddenly is just gone. And it's just, it's such a terrible thing for those who experience something like this, or those who love those who experience something like this. But then in the background, little children who don't fully appreciate the gravity of the scene, who are laughing, right? Ran laughing among the modest, ordered headstones in the wind beneath the veiled and sinking sun, alive as fire, brief and hungry with that abandon, which is a kind of praise. It's a chillingly beautiful poem, Sally. It really is. And that set of contrary, this is what I most love about the best Christian poetry, right? This accentuating of contrary feelings that become more and not less poignant in light of the vast horizon of the reality of God.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think, you know, part of I think why people might bridle at being labeled as Christian poets or as religious poets is the assumption that with that comes, you know, a set of foregone conclusions, and that if you are a religious poet, you know, what you're doing is just rehearsing what you already know, because you've been given the answers and you're just setting them out. You're saying the correct things because that's what you have affirmed to be true. When in fact, what is true is a lot bigger than and more difficult. I mean, you can assent completely to the truths of your faith and just say, yes, I'm a Catholic. And when you become a Catholic, you say, you know, I assent to all the Catholic Church believes, teaches, and holds, you know, and you have to say that with your whole heart, you know, you can't be lying, but in no way are you saying, life is now going to be simple and all I'm going to do is repeat these answers, you know, because I'm still going to be confronted by, you know, the death of my friend's child. You know, I am still going to have to stand at this graveside, you know, and people's reaction is going to be, you know, people will say all the kind of pious thing, you know, isn't that, you know, wasn't that such a beautiful ceremony, you know, or whatever. But then, you know, there's also the, this poem is pretty much straight reportage of things that happened on a particular day, which is kind of unusual for me, you know. I mean, I usually change details, but this is, I wrote this poem a couple of years, this one I do kind of remember because I think this event that the poem talks about happened in maybe 2010. And in 2012, I was writing sonnets for Lent. Like that was my Lenten discipline that year, was to write a sonnet every day. And so, you know, you're scraping around, like, what am I going to write about? And this scene came back to me, and there were so many, I mean, I had to exclude so much about things that actually happened that day. I could have written a lot of poems, and I just wrote this one. But you know, there were a lot of kids at this funeral. It was our whole parish. Everybody brought all their, my kids were all there. You know, all these families that, you know, the siblings of the baby who had died, who ranged in age from about 25 or 30 down to 3, I think, you know, mm-hmm. It's a really large family. And they'd all been sitting still, you know, all this time. I mean, on the sort of just naturalistic level, this makes sense. You have all these kids, they've been good all through the mass. They've been good all through the drive to the cemetery. They've been good all through this burial, and then they just can't, you know.
Yes. Yeah,
right. the minute the grown-ups go, okay, that's over, the kids just go pow, you
that's
know.
Right. That's right. Yeah, what's great in this poem though, what I love about it is that you get a sense the kids have been good, they've been good, they've been good, mm-hmm. but then at the end that they're glorious because they're laughing amidst this, just the deep pathos of this burial.
Right.
You know, and what you say
and
about
they're alive.
Exactly. You know? That's right. It's so, you know, vibrant.
However brief that is, I mean, it's funny. I was talking to a friend of mine about this poem, and he said, well, I really like this poem, but I just don't buy that first line. And I said, well, that is exactly what she said. Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm just this direct quote. She got up that morning and said to her children to prepare them for this funeral. I mean, basically, she said, we're all like her. Mm. All our lives are an eyelash. You know, and she, and so,
yeah, you know, all our lives are just an eyelash.
And to see these children, you know, kind of responding to that at the end, like maybe we're just an eyelash, but while we're alive, we are alive.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, I love that. One thing I just want to say before we move to your novel, you said about the label Christian poetry as though somehow the answers are already there. This is right. Mm-hmm. What I love though about the poems that capture, you know, kind of life's seeming contradictions or paradoxes is that God's presence makes them both more poignant and in some mm-hmm. ways more confounding, not, right. you know, just more reassuring at all. I know when I was in my mid-20s, I had a very close friend of mine die in a plane crash, which was just horrific and terrible. And it didn't destroy my faith in God, but it made that faith more challenged. It's like if there is no God, then we're all matter, and when matter falls to the earth and some of that matter is alive, then that matter can die. And it's actually easy to explain if there is no God. If there is a God, why? And what kind of God allows this to happen? And this is the Jobian kind of question that gets more complicated, right? And that's where it gets more complicated, and it gets more interesting, gets more enriched. Yeah, it gets more alive for me.
Oh, yeah. I think absolutely. I mean, there's a verse from St. Paul's epistle to the Colossians that figures as an antiphon for evening prayer in the Liturgy of the Hours. And the way it's translated in our Liturgy of the Hours is, he holds all creation together in himself. And I come back to that so often because that is, I mean, creation in all of its paradox and its fallenness and its brokenness and its capacity for good and evil and everything else, that somehow he is holding it all together. And that's why it exists. And that doesn't answer the hard questions at all, but it's, you know, it's like there is, somebody is holding this.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And it is together. It's not all going to shatter. You know, somehow in ways that we can't see, it does cohere.
I love that. Thank you. Let's turn to this novel, Works of Mercy.
Okay.
Now, you were already a poet, right? What mm-hmm. moved you to take up fiction? And I'm curious about this. Was the process of writing the novel, was it radically different from writing poems, or did they draw on the same creative parts of yourself?
Probably both. It is radically different, but working in prose is just it just feels very different. I mean, partly because, you know, I mean, with a poem, you go back and you put in a semicolon or you take out a semicolon and you say, well, I've done that now, you know, whereas just the scale of something in prose is so much bigger. But the thing that is interesting and fun about fiction is the way that you have more room to move around in terms of building a world. I mean, the burden is on you to build a plausible world. So that's the challenge. But you also have a lot of room to just, you know, to write landscapes mm-hmm. and to write people in scenes. And I don't know. I mean, that just scratches a really different itch, I guess. Not to go on too long about it, but just does.
What interests me about this novel, though, is, I mean, it'd be one thing, you know, if you were writing a Dan Brown style, you know, kind of like barn burner, you know, where there's
right.
like something breathlessly happening in every page, which means there's nothing breathlessly happening
right.
at all. but the idea,
right.
if it were like, you know, sort of rollicking from scene to scene, you know, basically car chases all the way through, it would be one thing. But it's
right.
not. It's
right.
a novel that really is about these reflective spaces that are so emblematic of often poems, that it would require, I think, special care attention to get it written, because you'd want to
yeah.
sort of really pause on paragraphs. Yeah, right. Well, you'd want to pause,
yeah.
right, on in these things. So the main character here is a woman who named Kirsty, a widow.
Mm-hmm.
Still active and able, she cleans the rectory, you know, at her church.
Yeah.
You know, and she reflects on the novel how she prefers being alone to being in company. Her husband's passed on, but she's not mm-hmm. mourning in any obvious sense. She's kind of okay being alone.
Right.
And one of the ways that she's brought out of herself is through the presence of a woman in her parish, a woman named Janet, who is just very different. I mean, she's comparatively, she's loud, she's oversharing, she's needy, you know, and toward novel's end, Janet's the victim of some very difficult life circumstances, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I really love about the novel is how Kirsty begins feeling this nagging sense, what I would describe really as a spiritual prompting, to visit and even befriend Janet. I mean, if I could just read a bit here of some pages 91 and 92. So she's reflected, is in her voice, Kirsty, she writes, Father Schuyler's reluctance to visit Janet Malkin made me feel uncomfortably that I should visit her myself. Mind you, I did not want to. Visiting people, entering their homes, seeing how they lived, in their very presence, this was a level of intimacy I could and did perfectly happily live without. And then she goes on below, I shall pray for them, I thought. Taking up my rosary, I piously did so, but the anxiety at the back of my mind did not ebb away. I'm curious, what's the significance of that sort of shift in her, in your eyes?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it is, you know, I mean, you're right that for her big problem is this self-sufficiency. And in one sense, it's a virtue, right? You know, I mean, especially in America, you know, we tend to think American self-sufficiency. We, you know, because she's not American, but you know, that's sort of a value in our culture. But she's a good, I mean, when I began to sort of discover her, and I had to ask, what's at stake for this? For why am I writing about this person? What kind of story can I make out of this person's voice? And it occurred to me that, you know, one thing that might be at stake for her is that her strength that she has built up, her independence, her self-sufficiency, which we could understand as a virtue, has become some kind of prison for her. And is the thing that is walling her off from other people, but also from the grace that God has to extend to her. And I really struggled with how to mediate these moments where, you know, how does she get from I am perfectly happy alone in my house to suddenly I am visiting this family? Because it doesn't just, you know, plausibly it wouldn't just happen like that. So the idea that she's trying to push it away and, you know, well, I'll just pray for them. And, you know, and the fact that something won't leave her alone, and the fact that she's been mad at the priest because he wouldn't go visit. You know, her first impulse is to say, this family is having this problem, and Father, shouldn't you, isn't this your job? And he says, not on Monday, my day off, and drives off. And she just wants to break his neck.
Yeah.
And so she, you know, at some level, she has to be asking, well, why am I so angry at him when I don't want to do this? And so maybe even if this is a thing that I don't want to do, it is the right thing to do.
I want to pick up on what you said here, though, because in my experience, you know, life does have its share of really dramatic experiences, you know, that kind of reveal mm-hmm. something important to us. But most mm-hmm. spiritual experiences are subtle. Right? And learning yeah. how to recognize the presence of God in one's life is about learning how to discern these kinds of small and quiet but poignant impressions, and poignant and persistent, you know? And poetry, right. I seems, is well equipped to capture these kinds of impressions, these very minute shifts in states of mind. I'm curious whether it was different for you bringing expression to them in fiction than it is in poetry.
Yes, because in one sense, you are much more aware of having to create dramatic scenes in fiction where something happens. I guess how I would explain this is that these kind of spiritual realities and, you know, can be their own kind of drama. I mean, it's an internal drama, but it's, I mean, that drama of I know the right thing to do and I don't want to do it, and I'm going to do everything I can not to do the right thing because I don't want to do it, yet in the end I'm going to have to assent to that. You know, it's a really interior kind of trajectory for somebody to experience. But you know, in fiction you can do this because you can show the inside of somebody's head, and you know, and that interior drama then has exterior consequences, obviously. You know, something eventually does have to happen in the world of human interaction or it gets really boring. But I don't know, to me this is all just profoundly, and I mean, human beings are profoundly interesting to me. I'm just yeah. interested in people and how they think, and you know, how people deal with what's hard for them and the ways that they delude themselves, and we delude ourselves
yeah.
about, you know, how am I going to deal with this? How am I going to deal with this without dealing with it? You know,
right. Yeah. Right.
Oh, well, I guess it's still, you know, no, that didn't really work. So plan B.
You know, I love, as you mentioned a minute ago, you mentioned grace. And I want to pick up on this because I love mm-hmm. Kirstie's reflections on grace late in the book. And these are prompted now not by her own circumstances, that she's talked about grace a lot because of things that are kind of her own kind of skeletons in the past, and how grace is kind of bound up in things that have also hurt her, and that the right. combination really stays with her. But now she thinks about this, Janet's family, and she, Kirstie sort of thinks this, I'm quoting you from your book, strange grace, I thought, but when was grace not strange? Its thoughts were not my thoughts, nor its ways my ways. Somehow, still, We had rubbed along together, that grace and I. Now here we stood together to see the pattern repeated. I'm curious what that pattern says to you about our relationship with God, or maybe about the literature making us more aware of those kinds of patterns.
I mean, I guess that with some illumination, we can see that things in our own lives have, you know, maybe things that we thought were complete disasters aren't. And, you know, that we didn't have hope at the time, but we can look back and say, oh, well, because of that, you know, these other things happened, you know, that we never stay, you know, like, I don't know, it's hard to say this without sounding really, you know, like fatuous or formulaic or whatever, but that trajectory from despair to hope, you know, if we can see that as a pattern in our own lives, then we're kind of primed to see it as a pattern in the way the world works. And, you know, maybe it means we can't really offer a comfortable answer to another person who's suffering. Mm-hmm. But if we can hold on to the idea that, you know, maybe this is going to have some meaning, you know, even if they're completely falling apart, you know, just kind right. of the way that hindsight gives you a vision of the warp and weft of things that another person in the moment doesn't have, you know, maybe you can stand there and like hold a place for hope for them or something. I don't know. That sounds really dumb, but
no, it doesn't, you know, actually. I'll just mention this. For me, I think that a Christian life is an exercise in perpetual defamiliarization, perpetual estrangement, in a sense that nothing that you see necessarily means, in God's eyes, what you take it to mean. I can enjoy periods of great prosperity where I thought those were just the best of times, but actually, you know, there's times that I maybe was not as sensitive to things as I should have been, and I was actually maybe drawing on my the worst parts of myself. Whereas some of the things that you suffer, you think, "Wow, this is terrible. I mean, how could I have gone through?" But those are actually periods that ended up being really important for virtues that you acquired or friendships that you made or things you learned to recognize in the suffering of other people, so that nothing is, all things are meaningful, but nothing is necessarily what you take it to mean.
Yeah. That's a great way to, I love that word defamiliarization, you know, the way everything you think you know isn't what you really know. Or it isn't, you think you know it, but you don't really know it. And that you're constantly being brought up against that, which is one, you know, it's how you attain humility, right? Yeah. Among other things, just to be able to say, I think I know this, but I don't know, which is one of the things too that, I mean, you know, in your 20s, you think you know everything. And you know, you hit your midlife and beyond, and you think, actually, I get up every day and just think, I don't know anything, you know.
That's right.
What do you know? Only that I know nothing. You know, you start to really feel like Socrates.
That's right.
Nothing. And, you know, and I think that is one of the, you know, the lessons of long experience, I guess. And yeah, I mean, I think that is how, I mean, grace works in our lives. And I think, again, I mean, there's actually, I mean, it was very interesting to me that you zeroed in on the poem Burial in Holy Week, because in my mind, there's a huge connection between that poem and this book, even though it's, and this novel, even though the people in the novel are fictional characters, you know, but the event of that prompted that poem is still very much in my imagination all these years later. And this friend of mine would say, I mean, if I told her that she was a profound person, she would laugh at me. I'm not profound, but she says these things like all our lives are just an eyelash. And when that baby died, one of the things she said to me was, I know graces are going to come from this. Mm. And I thought, wow, that is an amazing thing for you to say in this moment. And, you know, but even as she said it, I mean, she didn't know where life was going to go. And, you know, it's interesting to look back over that, you know, over the last decade and plus. And I know somehow all of this coheres in my mind as as a kind of experience that I probably will always be writing about on one level or another.
Let me conclude then with this observation. There's a moment in the novel when Kirstie is reflecting on the quirky but really unique life of a character who meets an untimely end. And she may well be reflecting, it seems, on the role of the writer or the artist. And this is kind of how I characterize a lot of what your work does. I'm quoting from the novel here. It says, "It was a vocation to be sent into the world to marvel at its strangeness. One could make a whole life of such work." That, I think, is how I kind of imagine you as a writer, Sally, which for me is a compliment to give to you, right? That to be sent into the world to marvel at its strangeness and to bring that strangeness and the marvelousness of that strangeness to our attention as readers.
Yeah, well, I mean, I certainly received that as a compliment. And I know that obviously I wasn't consciously thinking that when I wrote that little passage, but I think it is true. I mean, in one sense, I think it's the vocation of every person in one way or another to marvel at the world. And which is strange. The world is strange. Much in it is strange to us. And, you know, it's really kind of at our spiritual peril that we become, you know, dulled to that. And, you know, and maybe it is the function of art. I mean, I think it is the function of art to be constantly saying, no, wake up. Here's how. Enter into this experience. And in this experience, you will be awake to something. You know, poetry and fiction in their own ways are inviting the reader into into some kind of totality of experience where you are putting on something that's happening and participating in it emotionally and experientially. And hopefully you come back from it with more vision then you went into it. So yeah, I mean, I definitely do see that as the vocation of the artist, certainly of the poet or fiction writer.
Thank you for making, for bringing that vocation in your own life, you know, and creating work then that kind of comes to us. It's beautiful work, Sally. I love it. And blessings to you in your ongoing inspiration, ongoing work.
Well, thank you. Same to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination Podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Sophia Snyder. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.